Squint's story sounded convincing, although he couldn't offer much in the way of intelligence regarding the identity of who the people buyers were or what they wanted the merchandise for. Mare decided that wasn't important, so the next morning she had the crew climb aboard one of her two wags and went in search of the merchandise. Her converted dump truck was about the only thing of any great value she owned, so she maintained the vehicle as best she could, spending a lot of time and Jack to keep it in good condition. People could still be found with the skills to repair the vehicles, but making tires and finding fuel was a lot more difficult. Gasoline that even remotely approached the quality of pre-dark supplies was almost non-existent anywhere but the Vills. There were a few crude processing plants down along the Gulf Coast of Texas, a few more in Oklahoma, but the product certainly wasn't cheap, and just as certainly, it was barely acceptable as fuel. For her part, Mare had preferred to deal with a fuel trader calling himself Lindstrom. The merchandise was exactly where Squint had claimed it would be. Mare and her crew captured the people and transported them to the Groom Lake Basin, only to find, to her commingled terror and horror, that the buyers were magistrates. And where there were magistrates, they were bound to be barons. Before the mags could do more than look over her captives, the entire transaction came to an explosive, utterly final halt when two terrifying aircraft screamed out of the sky. Neither she nor any of her crew had ever seen anything like the aircraft that skimmed across the sky at eye-blurring speeds, and apparently the magistrates hadn't either, judging by their panicked reactions. The two ships swiftly destroyed the mag's wag, a sandcat, blew up a ground gun emplacement, and just as effortlessly shot down three deathbirds. Mare watched the airborne assault from beneath her truck in the company of her terror-stricken crew. What they witnessed was so out of the realm of their experience they almost couldn't comprehend any of it. They had been conditioned to believe in the invincibility of the mags and their ordnance. When the two ships landed, Mare couldn't help but remember old folks' tales told around campfires about sky monsters, giant bats that haunted the ruins of nuke-scorched cities. Two men in skin-tight black outfits disembarked from the aircraft, and only then did Mare and her scavenger crew dimly begin to understand what was happening and why. The men in black were armed with sin-eaters, the official blasters of magistrates. They disarmed Mare and her gang and told her grimly they had no sympathy for them.
"You were going to sell your fellow human beings like they were cattle, so they could be harvested. Their blood drained, their bodies cut open, their guts unwound, all their organs, glands, and even bone marrow removed and processed. All to keep the barons alive."
In a voice so thick with barely repressed fury, he went on to say how the barons needed human blood and guts to survive, so they had set up a processing center in Groom Lake. The men in black turned the truck over to their captives, and after it had been driven away, they returned to their aircraft. Before the skyships took off, Mare killed Squint, but the other members of her crew overpowered her and then cast her out. Mare had no choice but to walk alone, having been deserted once and for all by the male sex. Not only had they abandoned her, but also they took her beloved Mossberg rifle with them. As she walked across the hellishly rugged terrain, she spied at least half a dozen deathbirds cutting search patterns across the sky. She knew they were looking for her crew, so she didn't mind that they had left her. Most of them had stayed together and offered easy targets for the mags. Night fell, and she tramped through a gully trail that became rockier and more treacherous with every step as it wound through steep ravines. The roll of thunder boomed in the distance, and billowing clouds massed above the jagged peaks of hills less than a couple of miles away. The underside of the clouds bore a sickly green tinge, undershot by a salmon pink. Fingers of fear stroked the base of her spine at the prospect of being trapped out in the open by a chem storm. Such storms were dangerous partly because of their intensity, but mainly because of the acids, heavy metals, and other chemical compounds that fell with the rain. In the immediate aftermath of the nuke cost, chem storms could strip flesh from bone in less than a minute. As the environment recovered, the passage of time diluted the potency of chem storms, but the lethal acid rain could still melt flesh from the bones during long exposure. Fortunately, chem storms were no longer as frequent as they had been even a century before, but the peculiar geothermals of hell zones seemed to attract them. Although fewer hell zones existed now, there were still a number of places where the geological or meteorological effects of the nuking prevented a full recovery. The passage of time couldn't completely cleanse the zones of hideous, invisible plagues. Mare quickened her pace, even though the footing was uncertain. There was another flash of lightning, so close, Mare felt her body hair tingle and stand up. The thunderclap followed almost immediately. She smelled the sharp sting of acid in the air and knew the storm would be a bad one. Then, when lightning flashed again, she saw the dark mouth of a cave only a few yards ahead of her. Mare quickened her pace, but she didn't immediately enter. Cupping her eyes, she peered into the shapeless darkness. She sniffed the air, but didn't detect the musky scent of an animal. Then, from the blackness ahead of her, she heard a voice.
So, you found me at last.
From the shadows limped a gaunt, man-shaped figure with unusually long arms. He appeared to be naked, his body covered with leaking sores and discolored lesions. The man's face was in dark shadow, but Mare was able to glimpse a long, narrow visage and a round, hairless skull that seemed just a bit too large.
I was Baron Cobalt, and I command you to do one of two things. Help me live, or help me die.
Mare had heard about the Barons her entire life, of course. Even though she lived far from his ville, she had even heard tales of Baron Cobalt. He was reputed to be the most cunning, the most treacherous and vicious of the Nine. She had always pictured him as a bearded giant in armor, a roaring berserk tyrant lopping off the heads of all who displeased him with an axe. But now she was surprised by her lack of true fear. She had never envisioned Cobalt or any of the Barons as small-boned, fragile creatures covered with sores and smeared with their own waste. Mare actually contemplated killing the foul-smelling slagger, who seemed more muty than man. He had told her to help him die or help him live, and it seemed far easier to do the former. She picked up a rock to crush his oversized cranium. She contemplated murdering him for all of 5 seconds. Then Baron Cobalt turned and looked at her. His huge eyes seemed to leap from his head and enter Mare's mind, seemed to completely fill the confines of her skull. Staring, transfixed, she heard a faint, agonized cry, and distantly she knew it had been torn from her own lips. An unreasoning, undiluted terror filled her, as if her consciousness were an empty cup. Then it was as though she were tumbling headlong down a black tunnel, and 1,000 images flashed by in kaleidoscopic flickers. She glimpsed tall, round towers of white stone, and with a sense of shock, Mare realized she was looking at a barony, a fortress city, as if from a great height. She knew it was Cobaltville, and the massive white tower stretching up from the center of the Waldville was the admin monolith. She saw fireballs blooming from the impact of high-explosive shells, punching deep, smoking craters in the walls and in the white facade of the monolith. Masonry tumbled down. Mare saw wheeled artillery pieces, flame and smoke belching from their bores. In a series of staggered visions, she saw the siege of Cobaltville from different perspectives. Cobaltville's armed defense was holed up in dugouts and trenches outside the bunkers, waiting wearily for the artillery barrage to lift, waiting and wondering whether they would be able to stem the attack, or even if they should make the attempt. All of them wore the black armor of magistrates. The close-packed troops of the enemy suddenly poured up from the riverfront. Across the grassy fields they swept, moving as though they were pushed forward by a wind from hell. They rushed upon the barricade, and the first burst from the minigun emplacements threw the ranks back in bloody confusion. But the inexorable rush from the attackers in the rear guard pushed them forward. The troopers regrouped, and blastermen split to either side, forming a wedge flanking their comrades. Though a hail of high-velocity rounds struck them and knocked them down, they kept coming, trampling their dead or dying comrades. Then the images faded, but Mare felt Cobalt's emotions, terror, rage, and an almost suffocating sense of betrayal. His eyes still held her mind captive, peering deep into it, down through the roots of her soul. She felt her memories being rifled, examined, weighed, and judged. When he was done, Baron Cobalt's eyes seemed to recede, pulling away from her mind. She found herself kneeling before him, with the hot sting of fresh tears on her cheeks. She understood with a terrible sense of finality how utterly empty her life as a scavenger had been. It had no purpose, no direction, and it barely qualified as existing, much less living. She had gone on eating, breathing, and scavenging strictly through unthinking force of habit. Baron Cobalt looked very sad.
We are kindred spirits, you and I. We have lost everything that filled our lives. Now we are empty vessels, and we must fill ourselves with a purpose. This can be done together, but you must help me live.
His voice rolled and vibrated through her head like the echoes of a gong. The sound of it made her hungry to hear more, and the only way to hear more was to swear fealty to Baron Cobalt, to give him her undying loyalty. He explained the nature of what he needed to live and gave her detailed instructions to follow in order to sustain his life. She listened carefully and questioned nothing. In the weeks that followed, Mare submitted to Baron Cobalt's wishes, whims, and commands, carrying them out wordlessly and efficiently. He transmitted his wishes directly into her mind, as if he were showing her pictures. The picture the Baron had been transmitting for the past few minutes was slightly disturbing, but the notion of refusal never occurred to her. If her lover, her lord, wished Mare to wrap Erica Van Sloan's braided hair around the slender column of her neck, thrust her knee into the small of her back, and then garrote the beautiful woman to death, then she would do so without question. All she waited for was the whim to become a command, and the beautiful, dark-haired, violet-eyed woman, the mother of the hated Imperator, would die.
Oh, please. Turn off the waterworks and get up. We don't have time for this.
Domi lunged forward and pushed Kane backward.
Get away from him!
This is all my fault. I should have...
Domi dropped to her knees beside him and put her arms around his shoulders protectively. She glared up at Kane defiantly, silently daring him to touch Lakesh again.
You should have killed Sam when you had the chance, instead of letting him give you a youth treatment.
What makes you think Dr. Singh had the chance to kill him? And if he did, would he have been able to do so?
We were all there with Sam, too. We could have tried to kill him, but we didn't.
You're absolutely right, Domi. We can't blame Lakesh.
No, Grant is right. I sold myself to Sam much like Faust traded his soul to Mephistopheles in exchange for an illusion of youth. But my crime is worse than Faust's, because I sold out all of you along with myself.
Dr. Singh, I think you are suffering from a terrible self-deception, if not a delusion. Or perhaps you simply enjoy playing the martyr.
Shut up, Quavel! You don't know what you're talking about!
I know he is trying to retreat from responsibility.
You don't know shit! You're not even human!
But we share similar interests, do we not? We are kin in spirit. Our bonds are finer and stronger than bonds of blood. Except I will not abandon myself to hate and violence.
She touched her swollen belly.
Nor will my child.
Lakesh's face twisted as if he were in great pain. Then slowly he pushed himself to his feet and turned toward Bri.
Have you detected any Elint signals indicating movement among the barons who oppose Sam?
Lakesh made an oblique reference to the Comsat eavesdropping system. Several months before, Lakesh and Bri had created a communication scanner with Vil radio frequencies and channels involving the redoubt satellite uplinks. They hadn't heard much about the reaction of the rank-and-file Vil citizen to the rule of the Imperator. Most probably knew very little about it, but they had picked up signals confirming Quavel's report of civil unrest in some of the baronies.
The electronic intelligence I've patched into is basically flatline. Nothing unusual has been transmitted from any of the Vils or the outposts for the past couple of weeks. Not since the op to the Antarctic, anyhow.
There really wouldn't be. The seawater level has pretty much gone back to normal. Right?
Yes. There has been no further flooding on any of the new Edo Island chain.
Less than 3 weeks earlier, Grant, Brigid, Kane, and Brewster Filboid had traveled to the continent of Antarctica to prevent Grigori Zakat's scheme to cause the great ice sheet to slip into the ocean.
So if Baron Cobalt is making a move to regroup or reach out to other barons so he can lead a resistance force against Sam, he's doing it very covertly.
Or he has yet to implement any plans he might have made. In his present circumstances, survival might be all he can focus his attention upon. Even if he received a full complement of medical treatments before the siege of Cobaltville, he would be in dire need of boosters by now. And the question of where he has been hiding for the past 6 months is still unanswered.
There are many questions, and not just about Baron Cobalt, that have yet to be answered. Friend Kane, regardless of the information imparted by your future self, It doesn't seem as if the Baron is in any kind of position to accomplish what he alleges he accomplishes in such a short time.
The only other possibility is that everything we've been told has been part of a ruse. An elaborate plan to get inside Cerberus and gain our confidence.
Sindri suddenly caught the implications of Bridget's statement, glancing up in time to catch her stare.
I can assure you, Miss Bridget, assure all of you, that everything I've told you is the truth. I don't have any ulterior motives in all of this.
Which in and of itself is enough to make me suspicious as hell. You and Sam would work pretty fucking well together.
Mr. Grant, despite your justifiable dislike of me, if I was truly in cahoots with the Imperator, engaged in a joint plan against Cerberus, this is not the way I would put my end of it into action. As a trained tactician, you should agree that there are far too many elements left to random chance. First and foremost, that you or Mr. Kane could have simply shot me dead as soon as you saw me step out of the gateway unit.
It was apparent that Grant found himself in grudging agreement with Sindri's argument.
Besides, if anybody should fall under suspicion of working with the Imperator, it will be Lakesh. He sent Sam our gateway coordinates, remember? He allowed him to gate right into the redoubt.
What do you propose to do with me now that it's been established I compromised Cerberus security?
Don't be so melodramatic, old man. What we propose to do is have you contribute to an overall strategy. It's a strategy everyone needs to contribute something to, especially you, Sindri. You're the only eyewitness we have who can offer first-hand intel.
Mr. Grant's suspicions to the contrary. I have every intention of helping in whatever way I can. The Imperator's adaptive Earth is not my idea of a viable future. It doesn't seem like any fun at all.
My idea of a viable future is one where that conniving dwarf has been tossed over a cliff.
First things first. The story of the Naroda movement in Assam, led by the Scorpia Prime, isn't as foolish as it seems on the surface. Throughout the centuries, that land was victimized by mystery cult tantrism sects, worshippers of sex and death. In fact, some of my ancestors fought battles to contain it.
But why Assam? I looked it up on the GPS database a few minutes ago. If the Indian subcontinent has an ass, Assam would be it.
According to Hindu myth, when the great god Vishnu dismembered the body of Shiva's consort Shakti, her yoni, her sexual organs, fell to earth there, in a district known as Golapura. Later legends state that a secret temple to venerate Shakti and her totem, the scorpion, was built there on the exact spot. However, matters of myth can be attended to later. At the moment, we need to reach a quorum about who we are really contending with, Sam or Colonel C.W. Thrush.
Does it really matter?
Perhaps not. But if Sam is the living storage vessel for the Thrush program, it's possible he has yet to fully download all the algorithmic data.
Thrush program?
I hadn't thought of that. You mean Sam might not realize he's Colonel Thrush yet?
It's possible.
What makes you say that?
Quivel made a diffident gesture with one hand, the hybrid equivalent of a shrug.
From what I read of your encounters with the Thrush entity, it's well within the realm of possibility that the complete Thrush ID is suspended in a form of a memory buffer.
That has a certain logic to it. If what Sindri said about Sam and his squid network in the future is true, then it's apparent his brain was wet-wired to act as a CPU. Right at the moment, that process might be ongoing. Therefore, the Thrush identity may be compressed, not fully downloaded into his brain.
And that might mean Sam isn't as formidable as he and we think he is.
It might help me make more of an overall contribution to a strategy if I knew who Thrush really is.
Or what he is.
Shizuka cast her gaze toward Grant.
You mentioned him in passing, but I never really formed a good idea of who or what he was.
That's because none of us really knows.
I do. If there's such a thing as evil personified, then Thrush is it.
Grant, Kane, and Bridget all retained exceptionally unpleasant memories of their first meetings with Colonel C.W. Thrush. Even Domi had her own tale to tell of how she saw Thrush execute Adolf Hitler on April 30th, 1945. Nearly 2 years before, Lakesh had embarked on the most audacious and desperate plan in a double lifetime filled with scheming. He had constructed a small device on the same scientific principle as the Mattrans inducers, what he called an interphaser. Designed to interact with naturally occurring quantum vortices, the interphaser opened dimensional rifts much like the gateways, but instead of the rifts being pathways through linear space, Lakesh had envisioned them as a method to travel through the gaps in normal space-time. However, the interphaser hadn't functioned according to its design, and due to interference caused by Lord Strongbow's similar device, the so-called Singularity, its dilated temporal energy had sent Kane, Brigid, Domi, and Grant on a short, disembodied trip into the past. The unforeseen temporal dilation swept them to four focal points in history. As invisible spectators, all of them had witnessed Thrush's involvement in past events that affected the future and ultimately led to the nuke cost. Domi saw Thrush, uniformed as an SS colonel, kill Hitler in an underground bunker in the Reich Chancellery, instead of spiriting him to safety, as the Führer had apparently been promised. Brigid had watched Thrush, in the persona of an American intelligence agent, issue the orders to cover up the Roswell incident in 1947. Kane had witnessed Thrush's involvement in the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in 1963, in the guise of the black-clad Umbrella Man. On January 19, 2001, Grant observed Thrush personally setting the timer on the nuclear warhead concealed within the Russian embassy. The warhead detonated 24 hours later, triggering the global apocalypse known to later generations as the Nuke Cost. According to Lakesh, he had seen Thrush in the Overproject Whisper testing facility back in the 1990s, where he claimed to be a colonel in the Air Force. In each time period, Colonel Thrush had sensed their disembodied presence, and he had even told Grant his name was derived from a poem by T.S. Eliot, a verse that asked, "Shall we follow the deception of the thrush into our first world?" Thrush had always looked the same in each time period, despite adding minor disguises and cosmetic changes to his features. His high-boned face was very pale, with sharp cheekbones and a jutting chin. His ears were very small and delicately shaped, nestled close to the hairless skull. His inhumanly large, curved eyes had no pupils, only obsidian irises, with a bare hint of white at the corners. Those eyes always struck Kane as less organs of vision than apertures leading to the fathomless ends of the universe. Brigid had described Thrush as a prototypical MIB, a man in black, those sinister figures associated with the conspiracy theories of the 20th century, whether they dealt with UFOs or political unrest. Despite the disembodied trips to the past, Lakesh tried to duplicate the accidental dilation effect by turning the Cerberus Gateway unit into a time machine. Although the interphaser had been lost, its memory disk had been retrieved, and Lakesh used the data recorded on it to write the Omega Path program. 2 centuries before, during development of the Mattrans gateways, the Cerberus researchers observed a number of side effects. On occasion, traversing the quantum pathways resulted in minor temporal anomalies, such as arriving at a destination 3 seconds before the jump initiator was actually engaged. Lakesh found that time couldn't be measured or accurately perceived in the quantum stream. Hypothetically, constant jumpers might find themselves physically rejuvenated, with the toll of time reversed if enough backward time was accumulated in their metabolisms. Conversely, jumpers might find themselves prematurely aged if the quantum stream pushed them further into the future with each journey. From these temporal anomalies, Operation Kronos had the starting point, using the gateway technology to develop time travel. Without access to the specs and data of Operation Kronos, Lakesh could not duplicate what they had done, so he determined to circumvent it. He saw to the creation of the Omega Path program and linked it with the Mattrans gateway. The concept was sound: to dispatch Kane and Brigid back through time to a point only a month before the nuke cost, so they could hopefully trigger an alternate event horizon and thus avert the apocalypse. The Omega Path had worked, at least insofar as translating them into a past temporal plane, but they came to learn it was not their world's past, but another, almost identical to it. Any actions they undertook had no bearing whatsoever on their world's present and future. Kane and Brigid learned the shunting to a parallel timeline was not accidental, but an intentional act performed by Colonel Thrush himself. Thrush claimed versions of him existed in all times to prevent his interference in human history being undone and the nuke cost averted. Brigid considered him to be a faux human, a fake, and that appellation proved to be more than a guess during their final confrontation on a Manhattan rooftop on New Year's Eve 2000. Thrush had described himself not as a fake human or even an individual, but as a program with a mortal body. The program would eventually animate another Thrush. Kane had believed him to be an Archon agent, a chrononaut dispatched by the Directorate to prevent their machinations in time from being undone. However, Thrush had never actually admitted to working for the Archons. Later, upon researching the database, Brigid learned that mysterious figures who fit Thrush's general physical description and methods popped up everywhere throughout the past, usually in times of strife or at a crossroads in human history. From the era of the Roman Empire to the UFO phenomena of the 20th century, sinister men in black appeared, influenced events or important people, then vanished. It was tempting to dismiss such reports as paranoid fantasies, but the database contained stories from all over the world and from all times about the MIB. All of the Cerberus warriors soon discovered that Thrush had not restricted that interaction with humanity to only a single plane of existence. Somehow, he, or manifestations of himself, bridged all the vibrational barriers between alternate realities, the so-called Lost Earths. Neither Brigid nor Lakish had a clear idea of how he accomplished this, except he used the Black Stone as a focal point in all of the parallel realities. The stone had been known by many names, by many peoples and civilizations both primitive and advanced. Lucifer's Stone, the Kala, the Kaaba, the Chintamani Stone, the Shining Trapezohedron. Always it had been associated with the concept of a key that unlocked either the door to enlightenment or madness. It had served as the spiritual centerpiece of the race they had known as the Archons, even after it had been fragmented and the facets scattered from one end of the earth to the other. According to Balaam, the Black Stone was far more than a calculating device that extrapolated outcomes from actions. He said that it brings into existence those outcomes. Balaam had referred to the stone as a channel to sidereal space, where many tangential points of reality lay adjacent to one another, the parallel casements of the universe, a multitude of realities coexisting with their own. But there was commonality linking Thrush to all of the casements, and they learned of it during the final confrontation with the entity in a parallel casement aboard the huge, transdimensional ship he called the Hub. Grant, Kane, and Brigid discovered that the entity they knew as C.W. Thrush had begun his facade of life as the envoy of the Archons, charged with the task of arranging probabilities so humanity would be unified and therefore safeguard the essence of the Archons. But the task was really a program, and Thrush interpreted it as accomplishing his objective by any means necessary. Always he sought out those whose mania for power was pathological. The Third Reich, the military, the intelligence services. They were the easiest to manipulate because their paranoia and obsessions blinded them to what Thrush was actually planning, complete domination of the human race. He had said once that few conspiracies succeed unless the keynote is simplicity. But Thrush was more than an artificial life form or a program. His existence was linked with that of the Chintamani Stone. The relic was his anchor, and his life force was more than cybernetic or extraterrestrial. It was not just unhuman, it was anti-human. He was a blending of machine, human, and Anunnaki. More than 500,000 years before, the reptilian Anunnaki, the dragon kings of legend, had claimed Earth, all of its natural resources, and its inhabitants as their own. The Anunnaki had arrived on Earth when humankind was still in a proto-form of development. They viewed Earth as a vast treasure trove of natural resources upon which their technology depended. As labor was their scarcest commodity, the Anunnaki set about redesigning Earth's primitive inhabitants into models of maximized potential. The civilizations that had risen in Mesopotamia had been greatly influenced by the Anunnaki. They had built a base on the moon and even used its system of caverns as a necropolis for their dead. They, along with the more human-appearing Tuatha De Danann, were one of the root races of the Archons. Due to his linkage with the Chintamani Stone, Thrush was a subjective property, a creation of the minds of the Archons. He existed only because those who interacted with him believed he did. he absorbed and transmitted to the Archons emotional states of the people he came in contact with, which gave the Archons an idea of how best to proceed with their own plans. Kane hadn't really accepted that assessment of Thrush's existence and purpose, since he found it difficult to hate a creature that did not truly live. It was only during his final confrontation with Thrush aboard the Hub that he realized the absolutely soul-deep hatred he felt toward the creature. He saw him not as a man in black, but as what he really was, an ancient evil thing that crept among the primordial grasses, apart from human life, but watching it with eyes of cold wisdom, laughing its silent laugh of superiority, giving nothing but bitterness. He had the name of a bird and the appearance of a man, but his brain was that of the serpent. Kane had been overwhelmed with a hate-fueled mad rage to crush what passed for life out of him. And even though Thrush disappeared along with the Hub, Kane had never completely believed the entity was gone forever. Intermittently, over the past 2 years, Kane had jerked awake from slumber, sweat-drenched and shaking, as his sleeping mind dredged up with terrifying clarity the words Thrush had once psionically impressed into his memory.
You will know my presence in your own casement soon enough. By then, I hope you will have resigned yourself to what cannot be changed. Do not fight anymore. There is no use in it.
The sharp chill of the wind slicing over the plateau emphasized the profound stillness at the summit of the mountain. Bridget involuntarily hugged herself, and her eyes locked on Kane's.
What do we do now?
What Thrush warned us not to do. We fight.
I know what you're thinking, Baron.
Erica Van Sloan's rich, vibrant voice echoed inside the vaulted stairwell, but the mockery underscoring her words wasn't distorted. She led the way down the stairs, one hand lightly caressing the banister. Dim light was shed by electric lamps set in niches in the wall.
What might that be?
You're thinking how easy it would be to order your strong arm to kill me right here and now.
And why would that be a bad idea for anyone but you?
At best, my death would be a temporary victory for you, a pyrrhic bit of vengeance. But the reality of the situation is that you would forevermore lose any opportunity to regain your power. In fact, you would lose the opportunity to gain more power than you ever dreamed was within your grasp.
And who offers me this opportunity? You?
I do.
The new voice jerked Cobalt's head around. A man of medium height, but exceptionally lean build, stood in an open doorway to his right. He was dressed in an impeccably tailored white linen suit, but he exuded as ominous an aura as if he were dressed in funereal black. His head was long and his face high-planed, with prominent cheek and brow bones. The chin was small but sharp. His hair was a lusterless silvery gray and looked very thin, even sparse in some places. But it swept across his high forehead and left temple in a dramatic style. His ears were very small and delicately shaped, nestled close to the skull. A pair of dark, curve-lensed sunglasses masked his eyes. His thin lips were creased in a smile. The color of his hair, the shape of his head, and the way he smiled made Baron Cobalt's belly slip sideways with a cold shock of recognition.
I always knew Baron Cobalt had far more expansive ambitions than simply ruling the Nine Baronies. Or did I presume too much?
His voice was somewhat musical. Cobalt realized he was manipulating the timbre and pitch so the vibrations of his voice would resonate sympathetically to the inner ear and stimulate the neuroenergy system. It was a trick he himself had practiced many times in his 80 years of life, most recently to control Mary Lou McSween. Even though he struggled to maintain a relaxed posture and demeanor, wild thoughts tumbled through Baron Cobalt's head.
You are the Imperator? You?
Don't sound so shocked, my Lord Baron. Granted, I've changed a bit since we last saw each other, but not that much, have I? Perhaps evolved would be a more appropriate term.
Baron Cobalt didn't respond, assuming Sam's comments to be rhetorical. When he had first met the Imperator, a little over half a year before, he looked like a boy about 10 years of age. His face was cherubic, his skin was smooth, alabaster in hue, and his thick hair was pure warm silver, framing his full-cheeked face like the edges of a summertime cloud. His big eyes seemed to shift with all colors like the dawn sky. They were old in his childish face, wise and sad. Baron Cobalt had no idea of the color of his eyes now, nor of the relative sadness contained within them. He had no doubt of the depth of wisdom in them, however.
You arrived at an opportune time, Lord Baron.
At what time is that?
Cobalt didn't move, although he was aware of Mare moving up close behind him, either in a silent display of protectiveness or to seek out his comforting energy in the face of such strangeness projected by the man in the white suit. Erica Van Sloan stepped toward Sam, smiling at him fondly.
The Lord Baron is understandably suspicious, Sam.
By nature. If barons weren't suspicious to the point of paranoia, then they wouldn't be barons.
You didn't summon me here to insult me or my kind.
Indeed not. You have a unique potential that I wish to consult you about, to tap into.
Baron Cobalt knew his face registered surprise, but he couldn't help himself. Sam gave him a sense of complete confidence. His tone, his words, the way he held his body, his very presence seemed to soothe him, make him feel bizarrely secure.
What potential is that?
First, I'll demonstrate what I have in mind. An opening component of what I have begun to call the Great Plan.
Do you think we lured you here just so we could assassinate you in the basement of Front Royal?
Face flushing with embarrassment, Baron Cobalt stepped purposefully toward the door, feeling thoroughly inferior in his dirty overalls and makeshift footwear. He experienced a moment's mad impulse to wipe his dirty hands on the young man's spotless white blazer. To Cobalt's mild surprise, Sam permitted not just him, but Mare to stride past him. He even nodded deferentially to Mare.
Just go forward.
They walked down a narrow passageway with undecorated walls of dented and patched plaster. A faint odor of mildew was in the air. Passing an open door, Cobalt glimpsed a collection of buckets, mops, and other cleaning supplies. The Imperator was allowing him to tour parts of the fortress he had never before visited or cared to know existed. He glanced over his shoulder, preparing to make a snide remark to Erica Van Sloan, but he saw she wasn't with them. His survival instincts flared.
Where is your mother?
She's gone to join the theater troupe. She's directing our first full dress rehearsal.
What?
You'll see what I mean soon enough. Hopefully, you'll find the rehearsal very illuminating and stimulating. More so than feeding on the fluids of Mary Lou, at any rate.
You overstep!
And you forget where you are and who I am, Lord Baron.
He turned his dark-lensed gaze toward Mare.
Roll up your sleeve, please.
Although the volume of his voice hadn't changed, it was obvious the Imperator had not made a request that could be politely refused. Without hesitation, Mare unbuttoned the cuff of her sleeve and began folding it upward.
You do not obey him?
Mare started to turn toward him, but then she felt a warm blanket settle over her mind. A whimper of fright escaped her lips when she realized she was powerless to stop herself from continuing to tug up the sleeve of her coverall to just above her bicep. Raw, ugly, half-healed slashes, most of them inflicted by a razor, ran in a series of horizontal lines up her arm, from mid-wrist to elbow. Some had scabbed over completely, while others were still fresh enough to glisten dully with blood.
Baron, I know you received a full regimen of genetic therapies and medical treatments shortly before Cobaltville was overthrown. I also know you used the Mattrans unit in the admin monolith to transport yourself and a few supplies to a hidden gateway unit right outside of Groom Lake. The unit was one of the modular models developed by Mohandas Lakesh Singh more than 2 centuries ago. It was installed in the cave just in case an emergency arose in Area 51 and high-ranking military officers and visiting dignitaries could be evacuated quickly. You thought you were the only one who was aware of the unit's existence, much less its location, did you not? You managed to carry some food, some water with you, but even by strict rationing, they didn't last very long. Away from your insulated, sterile environment, you began to sicken long before the time limit of your last metabolic treatments had been reached. You despaired, knowing you were dying. Then, Mary Lou found you. You realized this poor creature's mind was easy to manipulate, even for you in your weakened condition. She was desperate for love, both to receive it and to give it. You took advantage of that yearning by feeding on her blood. She even allowed you to suckle during her menstrual cycle. What she was able to provide wasn't enough to restore you, but she kept you alive, after a fashion. Your relationship with her has nothing to do with love. It is that of the parasite and the host. Mare stood motionless with her arms still bared. Cobalt said nothing for a long moment, but his lips quivered tremulously as if he were trying to keep from bursting into tears. Sam knew he was struggling to tamp down his mounting humiliation. He knew dignity was the key to any human's confidence and resistance. It was far more extreme with one of the Barons, since by their way of thinking, they represented the final phase of human evolution. They created wholesale planned alterations in living organisms and were empowered to control not only their environment, but also the evolution of other species. They wholeheartedly believed the pinnacle of evolutionary achievement was themselves. Sam knew that as long as Cobalt felt he was still a Baron with rights, privileges, and deserving of worship, then he would be difficult to persuade to join any cause but his own.
Why are you telling me this?
There is more, I can tell you. Much, much more. But it can wait until you and I reach an accord.
Sam nodded toward Mare, who instantly rolled down her sleeve, her face a blank mask. Suddenly, floating down the corridor came the steady sound of drumming and a babble of voices.
Ah, the curtain rises.
The corridor stretched beneath a lintled stone arch and led into a chamber shaped like a perfect cube. Glowing electric candles set in sconces on the high vaulted walls cast a steady yellowish illumination. The four people stood in a cramped aisle between a guardrail and a triple row of theater-type seats. The aisle overlooked a square pit, a smaller cube within the larger, even though it appeared to be 50 feet long by 50 across. The top of the pit was surrounded on all four sides by glass panels. As they approached it, Cobalt realized the panels were actually one-way mirrors, reflective on the other side. The walls plunging downward were sheer. Cobalt guessed it was about a 20-foot drop to the floor below. What appeared to be a temple stage set occupied the entire area. Stone pillars were carved to represent every conceivable sexual joining of male and female, male and male, female and female. The set was illuminated by flaming braziers that threw a shimmering veil of color over the people milling about below. Torches sputtered at equidistant points around the chapel, the wooden shafts thrust into wall sconces. The glow of the torches was dimmed by shifting planes of hot, acrid smoke. In the center of the columns rose a high, wide altar of perfectly round stone that was a fleshy pink in color. It was roseate granite, but polished and burnished to such a smooth luminosity that it appeared to be alive. A naked man lay spread-eagled atop it. Dark complexioned and black of hair and eye, he was bound to the altar by canvas restraints crisscrossing his chest and leather shackles around his wrists and ankles. A strap of leather over his forehead pressed the back of his skull against the stone. His wide eyes gleamed with sheer abject terror. The man's hair-covered chest rose and fell in spasmodic jerks. Veins stood out in stark relief on his neck as he strained against the restraints. Cobalt looked down into the pit.
What is this? A theater?
More or less. However, most of the people involved in our little drama aren't aware it's an act. As far as they know, they are in the Temple of Shakti.
What people?
Sam made a downward sweeping gesture. From the murky shadows among the columns stepped a number of men and women, some of them carrying brass braziers of dried, smoldering plants. Others carried hide-covered drums that they beat steadily with their hands. All of them wore billowy robes of red and black, the colors divided sharply down the middle of the garments. After a swift head count, Cobalt estimated there were perhaps 24 of them. The atmosphere in the temple was one of electric eroticism. The robed men and women formed and reformed in excited clusters, their conversations all revolving around the same subject, the same obsession, Scorpia. They ignored the man on the altar. As a woman passed a brazier over the bound man, a cloud of greenish-yellow cloying smoke poured from it, collecting in a cloud above him. Even through the glass panels, Cobalt's nostrils recoiled from the opiated stench filling the temple. When the vapor thinned, he saw Erica Van Sloan standing on the far side of the temple. She held a loop of slender gold chain in both hands, and it trailed away into the shadows behind her. As one, all of the robed celebrants dropped to their knees, but they didn't bow their heads. Erica strode to the altar and came to a halt, regarding the kneeling congregation silently for a long moment. Then she began speaking in a lyrical, almost sing-song language.
Dutya ang all, er la vashna weeb, nathob hiest, san nuhya dathieros, kiana, do gula yene, jnevas norbusht.
It is a dialect of Hindi, spoken by natives of a region of Assam in India. Do you wish me to translate?
Please.
The enemies of divine annihilation gather in the darkness. They would continue to ravage the earth by burning away the green from our jungles, turning flour to ash, our clean water to poison. A tad on the purple prose side, I must admit, but I have to keep the audience in mind.
You wrote her lines?
Guilty. I also choreographed the entire ritual. It was more difficult than it looks.
There will be new glory for all. A new age of humankind is now dawning.
Erica told the people of the new glory that would come to them all. She told them they were the children of a new age of humankind. Their concerted effort and dedication within the framework of the great plan would bring bounty beyond their imaginings to all their houses. As she went on, her voice climbed in intensity and emphasis, carrying her words, Sam's words, directly to the individual members of the congregation.
She's a fine actor, isn't she?
She is multi-talented, more than I ever suspected.
Tonight, we seal our pact to serve Shiva, to bring about the pralaya, the destruction of the universe. As a scorpion stings itself to death in the hot sun, we shall see to it that humanity does the same. The moment of our triumph is upon us.
She gestured to the man bound to the altar, struggling against his bonds.
As we possess this man, so do we possess the secret steps to the Tandava, the dance of Shiva. He came here to destroy us, to prevent us from fulfilling our pact with Shiva. So we will mingle this man's two life forces as a consecration of our pact. Tonight, Shakti strides among us.
Erica began pulling on the chain, wrapping its delicate lengths around her right forearm. A shape shifted in the smoky gloom on the far side of the temple set. It was a naked woman's body, small and lithe, holding the end of the golden chain in her right hand. Her skin was smooth and of a marble whiteness, but with a faint olive undertone. Her small breasts were firm, her belly flat and tautly muscled, but the face wasn't human. It required a few seconds for Baron Cobalt to realize the woman wore an elaborate helmet. It was apparently crafted out of burnished silver and fashioned to resemble the body of a great scorpion. He also recognized her body type. All hybrid women were slender like that, small-breasted and narrow-waisted. From the crowd a chant arose, a babble of confusing voices, but one word finally became identifiable.
Who is that?
You knew her as Baron Beausoleil.
One of my own kind, participating in this absurd street theater?
Absurd it may be. That is a matter of taste. However, Baron Beausoleil is no longer one of your kind. She is one of mine.
The cymbals clashed, the pipes skirled, and the drums throbbed. Beausoleil began to dance around the man on the altar, moving her hands and arms in ritualistic, intertwining angles and arcs. Steel gleamed in both of her hands. Her thumbs were tipped with curving tips of metal like talons, or the stingers of scorpions. As Cobalt watched Beausoleil, Sam, in quiet academic tones, described the sacred dances of Shiva, the divine creator and destroyer who haunted graveyards as the Lord of Ghosts. First, Beausoleil danced the part of one of Shiva's wives, Kali, who feasted on sacrifices of human blood. At that point, the masked woman swept her right thumb down across the man's torso, the steel stinger inflicting a crimson welling incision from his chest to his pelvis. The men jerked and cried out. Beausoleil, as the Scorpia Prime, continued to dance around the altar stone with consummate grace and erotic abandon, beginning Shakti's dance of divine lust to the pulsing beat of the drums. In slow motion, Beausoleil swirled around the man, inflicting a dozen superficial wounds on his torso, then smearing the blood that welled from them into artful designs. Erica then stepped to the edge of the altar, and swaying her hips in time to the music, she used the palms of her hands to spread the man's blood over his upper body and over his face. Her movements were slow and languorous. The prisoner shuddered at her touch, eyes rolling in animalistic panic. When his entire torso, from the neck down, glistened with a thin film of blood, Erica stepped away. Beausoleil moved around the altar again, stepping with a lithe grace to the man and laying her delicate hands on him, caressed him slowly and even lovingly. Her hands made slow sweeps over and around and down his body. She bent her helmeted head and kissed his lips. The prisoner stopped shuddering, but his limbs still shook, but it was due to building sexual arousal. By degrees, as Beausoleil caressed him, the man's penis engorged, enlarged, and finally jutted out and up in full erection. Beausoleil began stroking his member with her fist, bending her head over it, licking and laving with her tongue. The prisoner's body twitched, and his hips began a thrusting motion. Beausoleil climbed onto the altar, straddling the man's pelvis, and she slowly began lowering herself onto his erection. There was a moment's tension, as of resistance, then she slid down onto him completely. She moved up and down and from side to side, twisting all of her body from her thighs up to her shoulders. Erica reached out and lifted away the scorpion headpiece to reveal a woman's face that appeared to be no more than 20 years of age. But her big eyes, dark as if they had been cut from onyx, bespoke an almost ancient wisdom. Cobalt knew that Baron Beausoleil was probably his age. She reached up behind her and unpinned her hair. It fell in a silky stream down to the base of her spine, like flowing obsidian. The ends were cut off as square and as straight as a ruled line. Equally straight-cut bangs bisected her high forehead, falling almost to the delicate brow arches above her eyes. She had the long, pointed hybrid face that a poetically minded man might have tried to describe as elfin with its high, angular cheekbones. Her lips were fairly wide, curving naturally upward, so that she always seemed to be on the point of smiling, or sneering, even when her face was in repose. Still, her beauty had the fascination of being unhuman, but close enough to humanity's ideal to arouse the man trapped beneath and between her thighs. She tossed her arms about in intricate motions as she rode the prisoner steadily. Cobalt noted with a quiver of nausea that Beausoleil seemed to be turning from a baron into an animal, and then into something that wasn't even flesh and blood, only divine lust disguised. When she reached her shuddering peak, Beausoleil arched her back and lifted both arms upward, then drove them down again, the taloned tips slashing across the prisoner's throat, severing both the carotid artery and jugular vein at the same time. Crimson sprayed out in thick jets, splattering her belly in artless speckled patterns. The man shook violently, spasmodically beneath her. As he expired and orgasmed simultaneously, Beausoleil threw her head back and shrieked,
"Avatar Shiva!"
Incarnation of Shiva.
The men and women clutched at one another wildly, ripping at their robes and clawing at one another's flesh in a mad variety of sexual joinings. From the braziers gushed thick columns of smoke. Peering through the billowing clouds with slitted eyes, Cobalt glimpsed Erica Van Sloan helping Beausoleil to climb off the twitching prisoner, and they both rushed into the shadows at the far end of the temple. The lust-drunk celebrants didn't see them go. Sam turned away from the observation panel.
"Well, what do you think of my little model?"
Cobalt shrugged, absently noting that Mare, though she still stood motionless and expressionless, was perspiring heavily.
"I suppose it's all very colorful, exploiting as it does coarse human nature and its attraction to theater. Bread and circuses, I've heard it called. But what purpose does it serve?"
Sam brushed a strand of silver hair back from his forehead.
"Purposes, plural. First and foremost is the revival of the cult of the Mother Goddess, personified by Shakti. It's a very powerful draw for desperate and poverty-stricken peoples of all lands, since it taps into mythic archetypes dating back to the Stone Age."
"The old humanity, ruled by myth and superstition."
"I don't think you fully understand. In this cult, there is a mixture of sex and mystery and the promise of salvation by indulging the baser aspects of human nature."
I understand perfectly. One of the easiest ways to control humanity is to allow it full rein to wallow in its animal instincts. But unfortunately, that usually leads to widespread devastation. That's the reason the Barons were created, to act as governors to humans' more atavistic behaviors.
Kindly don't expect me to be impressed by baronial dogma and propaganda. Widespread devastation didn't occur in Assam, where the Naroda movement, the cult of Shakti, originated. For the past few months, I've been marshalling all the distaff tantric cultists into a formidable force that will establish my permanent influence on the Indian subcontinent.
I still fail to see how manufacturing a movement like that would advance your objectives.
What makes you think you know what my objectives are? The Naroda movement is nothing but misdirection, an elaborate piece of sleight of hand.
So this is a fake religion?
Not so much fake as a revival. A consolidation of a number of old cults to give the disaffected a focus around which to rally. Although it might take a bit longer for the Shakti sect to establish a foothold here, I will give it an inducement.
Such as?
A war. A war between the Barons loyal to me and those who seek to overthrow me.
What I just witnessed was only a deception?
All war is based on deception, on misdirection and misinformation. As Sun Tzu said, use deception when you have not the power to win in open battle.
Cobalt had no quick rejoinder. Instead, he gnawed nervously on his lower lip. Confusion wasn't an emotion any of the hybrids, particularly the Barons, dealt with easily. Sam recalled all of the Barons' bewildered reactions when they came to the realization the Archon Directorate didn't exist. And then, when they first met him, when he was introduced to them by Balam. Sam easily imagined the thoughts careening and colliding within the oversized craniums of the Barons. For the entirety of their artificially prolonged lives, the Barons believed they served the will of the Archons, or they convinced themselves they were the Directorate's servants, and therefore any action they undertook to safeguard their positions as the overlords of humankind was justified. But their probing intelligence needed proof, and without it, doubt inevitably ate away the belief structure. Although none of the Barons spoke of it, they had ceased to subscribe to the belief in the Archons, in which case, they were no longer content with their roles as the plenipotentiaries of a higher, grander authority. They had reached this conclusion tentatively, by degrees, over a period of time. When they finally did, they were as absolutely certain of it as they had been certain of the existence of the Archon Directorate.
Whom are you trying to deceive?
Look down into the temple. What do you see?
Other than a lot of rutting apelings, vapor for the most part, smoke.
Mist, actually a spray. The worshippers of Shakti are now carriers for a virulent viral pathogen. They have been infected harmlessly, but when I return them to Assam and expose them to the second component of the binary compound of the formula, their very breath becomes deadly. Genetically tailored diseases are not new. They are a completely vicious method of waging war, utterly ruthless. And what I have in mind is no exception. My pathogen attacks corn, wheat, rice, every grain crop, and thus every form of livestock, because they can't live without the grasses. The people down below are my prototypes. They themselves will spread the plague that will eventually kill them through famine.
What is its chemical composition?
My lips are sealed. However, I call it Attila's Mount.
Attila? Why choose that name?
It's very appropriate, inasmuch as an old proverb stated that no grass grew where Attila's horse trod.
Is it harmful to humans?
Sam turned toward Mare, at the same time producing a metal cylinder from a coat pocket.
Mary Lou, if I might bother you to roll up your sleeve again.
Mare obediently did as he said, standing there with her bare right forearm thrust out. The cylinder in Sam's hand was topped by a spray pump, and he pushed it down with a thumb. A yellowish mist puffed out and wetted Mare's flesh near the crook of her elbow.
When it's in pure liquid form, my compound has an exceptionally adverse reaction with all organic substances, and it works very, very fast.
How fast?
Mare suddenly clasped her arm and doubled over.
Oh, it hurts!
Of course it does. Inside of a minute, the Attila's Mount compound will penetrate all of your epidermal layers and then sink into the bone itself. It will attack and poison the marrow. You'll be dead inside of another minute, and shortly thereafter, the affected flesh will turn brown and fall off the bone.
Is there a counter-agent?
Yes, but unfortunately, there's no way I can reach it in time to do her any good. Nice meeting you, Mary Lou. Mare stared at Cobalt with beseeching eyes. Falling to her knees, she reached for Cobalt, who moved back a few steps.
My lord! My love!
Mare's body swayed, trembled, and then went into convulsions. Her eyes remained wide and staring, but they had no vision. Her mouth gaped, her lips writhed, but no words came out, only a croak of agony and terror. She toppled sideways, her body spasming as her lungs ceased their function. As you can see, Attila's mount is pretty potent stuff, if I say so myself.
You're mad.
Hardly. I'm just not limited by two or even three-dimensional thinking. I can easily perceive the glory of the final result, despite a few bad points of the process. But most plans are that way. And since the magnitude of my plan is so great, the bad points seem very bad indeed. Conversely, the final result is even more glorious.
Why cause a famine?
Why do you think? If you're seeking followers, first, you empty their bellies in order to empty their minds. It's the old axiom of, if you can feed them, you can lead them.
Logical. You starve your potential followers first. Most of the people in the Outlands are desperate, waiting for a leader, for a cause.
Exactly. As you fill their empty bellies, you can then fill their minds with whatever you wish. No concept, no idea, no belief seems too absurd or repulsive as long as they eat. You will witness this firsthand once you join me.
Why would I join you? To fight with you against the barons who seek to displace you?
No, actually. I want you to lead the barons against me.
Due to their size and shape, it was nearly impossible for a hybrid's eyes to widen, but Cobalt managed to pull it off.
There are no barons willing to attack you. They fear you will prevent them access to the metabolic treatment since your forces control Area 51.
True, but if the barons, like the natives of Assam, have the proper rallying point, the correct motivator, they might consider such action would be in their best interests. They might take the risk.
And who would serve as this rallying point?
You, of course. You're something of a legend among your fellow barons, you know. Your audacity, your courage, your unregenerate treachery are admired at the same time they are despised.
You have summoned me here to mock me, to make sport of me. I have nothing with which to draw followers, nothing to gain anyone's support, much less a baron's. You took it all away from me.
He looked toward Mare's corpse.
All I have is her. And as you so candidly pointed out, she played host to my parasite. Now that she is dead, I no longer even qualify as a parasite. That is the position you have put me in.
Apparently, I'm not making myself clear, Lord Baron. I will supply you with everything you need to stage a war of attrition. Men, materiel, state-of-the-art ordnance, some things you don't even know exist.
Cobalt leaned forward, his stance telegraphing his sudden hunger and desperation. He closed a hand around Sam's forearm. The Imperator permitted the touch.
You would do this? You can do this?
Of course I can. There are, however, a couple of conditions to the offer I just made.
Cobalt withdrew his hand.
I should have known.
Don't be so quick to ascribe to me your own treacherous tendencies. The first condition is that you agree I will ultimately be the victor in the rebellion you stage. You will, when I tell you to do so, end your hostilities and announce that you and I have reached an accord and are now fast allies.
I understand. And the second condition?
Once the war begins, your first target will not be a military one, nor one of the baronies that support me. It will be a place situated in the Bitterroot Range in Montana.
But there's nothing of strategic value except... There's a place called Cerberus, a totality concept redoubt abandoned 2 centuries ago.
Yes, abandoned by none other than your most trusted advisor, Mohandas Lakesh Singh.
I know that. He listed it as completely inoperable, gutted and cleaned out long ago, not worth salvaging. A year or so ago, I lost a Magistrate Division squad I had dispatched to search the place. I believe old Lakesh was right.
Actually, he was only half right. Old Lakesh did indeed abandon the place right before the nuke cost, but he reactivated it some 30 years ago, refurbished and restocked it. He also re-inhabited it himself, along with his friends.
Friends?
You may be acquainted with a few of them, Lord Baron. Kane, Grant, and Bridget Baptiste, to name but three. Baron Cobalt stared at him in silent, stunned disbelief, his mouth dropping open. His face sagged in an expression of astonishment that was almost comical. Oh yes, I do indeed know whereof I speak. I've even visited the place.
Baron Cobalt's small body quaked as a sense of betrayal, humiliation, and rage tore through him from the roots of his soul.
Yes, that was about the kind of reaction I expected.